From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
With national polls showing a virtual tie in the presidential race, what is the route to victory in the Electoral College? I'm Lawrence O'Donnell, sitting in for Warren Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. The Obama-Biden ticket got a bounce in the polls after the Democratic convention, and the McCain-Palin ticket got a bigger bounce after the Republican convention. What are the polls telling us? Are voters really changing their minds from week to week, or even speech to speech? With the candidates running a virtual tie in the national polls, what are the state polls telling them about the route to victory in the Electoral College? On Reporter's Notebook later on, the sidelining of New England's Superman, Patriots quarterback Tom Brady. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
I'm Lawrence O'Donnell, sitting in for Warren Olney, back with To the Point from PRI. What do national polls commissioned by major newspapers really tell us about the presidential race? Why do all the polls come up with different results? Why do the campaigns tell us they ignore those polls? And how do the poll results influence voters? And what polls do the candidates use in deciding how to deploy their resources and chart the course to victory in the Electoral College? On Reporter's Notebook, the leader of New England's Super Bowl dream team is sidelined for the season. First, this news update. President Bush announced today that about 8,000 U.S. troops will be withdrawn from Iraq by February, but that thousands of additional troops will be sent to Afghanistan before he leaves office because of worsening violence in Afghanistan. Here is what the president had to say.
While the progress in Iraq is still fragile and reversible, General Petraeus and Ambassador Crocker report that there now appears to be a degree of durability to the gains we have made.
Joining us now, Gordon Lubold, Pentagon correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Gordon Lubold, does this indicate a shift in emphasis toward Afghanistan or an attempt at a maintenance of a status quo in both Iraq and Afghanistan?
Yeah, that is a good question. Potentially, this really is kind of a compromise deal between people who wanted to do more for Afghanistan and potentially less for Iraq. And it's a true compromise because it seems to kind of make everybody upset. It could go down as a moment in which the president has attempted to try to do everything and maybe nothing well, which is to say that pulling one brigade or so out of Iraq and sending one brigade over to Afghanistan, while it has a big impact in Afghanistan, isn't necessarily going to seal the deal there, as they say, and it potentially undermines the security improvements in Iraq.
Well, was there a way to do both well?
Well, a lot of the people I've been talking to the last couple of days, you know, have suggested that it is hard to do both things well, and that there's this momentum in Iraq, and that it's that by kind of piecemeal, by withdrawing troops piecemeal this way, and this quickly. It's funny because in many ways the withdrawal of troops really doesn't happen until next year from Iraq, any significant numbers, but it's still seen by some people who think that troops should remain in Iraq far longer as rushing out of Iraq. It will have an impact to send more troops to Afghanistan, but potentially he's putting himself into President Bush has put himself into a corner.
Does your reporting in the Pentagon indicate some degree of disagreement with the president's choices on this?
Yeah, what it is General Petraeus, who is the top commander in Iraq, had essentially carte blanche to make recommendations and to see those recommendations occur, you know, go through. This time around, Admiral Mullen, who's the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, is attempting to essentially restore power to that office and wanted the recommendations from General Petraeus to kind of go through him. It is a compromise, but there was this kind of tension because the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, as well as some of the other members of the Joint Chiefs, want to see more troops for Afghanistan, but there's this other push inside the building to make sure that, you know, they don't squander the improvements in Iraq. So this is a compromise deal, but there's still kind of prickliness all around.
And when the next president takes office in January at the first National Security Council meeting, what will the discussion be then on troop levels in Afghanistan and Iraq?
Certainly depends on who wins the presidency. But I think both candidates have expressed a desire to do more in Afghanistan. And I think the conventional wisdom is that Afghanistan will need at least another two or three brigades, combat brigades, either infantrymen and also trainers to build up the Afghan national forces, regardless of what happens in Iraq. It's a question of timing, because if they can't pull the forces out of Iraq into next spring and summer, they really won't have them available for Afghanistan. So it's a really, you know, General Conway, who's the commandant of the Marine Corps, talks about having 2 feet, 1 foot in the canoe and 1 foot on the dock. You can't do both. It's got to be kind of one or the other. So they have to make a decision about Iraq and then decide and go from there.
Is this an odd period for commanders in the Pentagon, knowing that the commander-in-chief is a few months away from changing, and how they approach that transition?
There's a lot of interest in this transition, which will be the first one during wartime since the Vietnam War. So there's a lot of interest in how this transition goes down. Most of these guys, these commanders and the senior kind of staff officials in the Pentagon, you try to just stay removed from it and march kind of forward as smartly as they can, making their own plans and contingencies, knowing that whoever comes in may throw them a curveball and say, we're going to, you know, withdraw more forces from Iraq suddenly, or we're going to leave it the status quo, and we have to try to come up with Plan B for Afghanistan. I think that, you know,
that's all the time we have. Gordon Lubow, thanks for joining us. In a moment, what the latest polls are telling us about the presidential race on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
I'm Lawrence O'Donnell, back with To the Point. The latest national polls indicate a virtual tie in the presidential race. Today's Washington Post poll shows Barack Obama holding 47% of the vote to John McCain's 46. What do the polls tell us about how the race has changed since the conventions? Why do all the polls come up with different results? Why do the campaigns tell us they ignore those polls? And how do poll results influence voters? And who has the clearer path to victory in the Electoral College? Our first guest is Mark Ambinder, Associate Editor of The Atlantic. Mark Ambinder, what do you make of the various polls that are coming out at this point, and why, if you could start off for our audience on the question of why do each one of them produce at least slightly different results?
Well, I feel like I'm on quiz show with all those questions. So to take the first question, there is always going to be some variance in public opinion polls, just given the nature of public opinion polls. But there is a trend in virtually all of these polls, which is that John McCain is doing 3 or 4 points better than he was doing in the summer. And I think that can be attributed fairly directly to the work that he did before the convention in getting weakly partisan Republicans to be more comfortable about the ticket, and the work he did at the convention in getting really base Republicans to be enthusiastic about the ticket. So look, I think we're still in a relatively 50-50 country. You're seeing after Labor Day, when most of the public is engaged, a fairly tight race.
I just want to give our audience some guidance on how to process these polls. I can tell you anecdotally, people ask me every time a new poll comes out whether this is the definitive one, whether we now know who's going to win. And it seems to me that there's a lot of overreaction to these polls when people open up their morning newspapers and see one adjustment or another. How would you recommend that newspaper readers process these polls in the next few weeks?
Well, I think there are several ways to look at it. And I think if you look at the polls themselves, the best thing to do, if you're interested, is look not at the necessarily the horse race numbers, the big numbers of each poll, but look at the internals and try to figure out from poll to poll what's changed. The second thing you should
Let's go back to explain what an internal is.
An internal is just a question within the poll. It's a question asked of a particular demographic or a particular group. For example, most of the polls that we see show a fairly significant, certainly a statistically significant shift among white women from Barack Obama to John McCain. So you can see, instead of catastrophizing if you're a Democrat, finding these polls catastrophic, you can break them down and figure out, okay, here's what might be going on. The other thing to do is give it time. I mean, I've always used as a rule of thumb the date of September 15th to really figure out whether or not either candidate got a post-convention bounce, because there is always, after major events, a lot of activity in the polls by low-information, highly engaged voters. These are swing voters who are very interested, but they don't know a lot about politics, and therefore they're very influenced by the daily scrimmages that we engage in. And they're the ones right now who are sort of fizzing. And just give it time. Wait a week. Average the polls together. Average the reliable polls together. There's certainly apples and oranges in terms of samples. And then you can begin to think about trends. But you know, the one thing that, again, if you're Democrats, and Democrats are the ones who are panicking these days, if you're a Democrat, you just have to look back and recall how quickly, particularly these daily tracking polls can change, and just if there have been periods, I don't mean to be rambling on, but there are many caveats, there are many cautions to give people when they're looking at a poll and they say, well, this is the poll that's going to determine the election. I mean, one other thing I will say, the last thing I will say before I stop this rambling rant, is that all of the polls suggest that still about 20% of the electorate is undecided. That means that they haven't decided. It's more than enough of the electorate to swing the election in any way, and you know, you'll probably see various swings.
Joining us now is Alan Abramowitz, Barclay Professor of Political Science at Emory University. Thank you for joining us, Professor.
Glad to be with you.
As Mark Ambinder just suggested, that he senses panic among Democrats when they're reading the most recent polls. That certainly is my anecdotal impression also. Is that panic justified?
No.
In a word.
I think Mark's absolutely correct that you have to allow some time for the immediate response to the Republican convention to sort of settle down and see, you know, where we are. I think you want to look at a variety of polls, both state and national polls, to really get a sense of where the race is. And, you know, what we've seen so far since the Republican convention indicates that John McCain has definitely gotten a bounce from the convention, but that, you know, the race is really looking not that different from the way it looked, you know, really before the Democratic convention. Tight race, maybe McCain doing slightly better now than he was before the Democratic convention, but we'll have to see if that holds up over the next week or two.
And what do you make of the most significant internal, as they call it, in the Washington Post poll today, a significant shift of support in the category of white women toward the McCain-Palin ticket? Does that necessarily represent white women changing their minds, or is that a new decision made toward a candidate from previously undecided voters?
I would be skeptical about any result for any, you know, subgroup within a poll. First of all, as soon as you start looking at subgroups, and admittedly, white women are a fairly large subgroup, but you know, your margin of error increases considerably when you start looking at subgroups. I would want to see evidence from several polls.
Just by way of explanation on that, if a national poll uses 1,200 respondents, your guess as to how many white women within 1,200 would be what?
Oh, you know, maybe 400, 450, something like that. I mean, that's still a pretty good number.
Since you're using a group of 400 to represent the national group, that becomes a less reliable number the smaller it gets, right?
Exactly. Yeah, and so there's really no way of knowing whether this represents a switch, whether it represents undecideds making up their mind. You know, because we don't have a panel data, for example, where we're re-interviewing the same people over time, although CBS did a panel survey. And what they found in their panel, if you look at the internals of it, this is where they did a survey in mid-August and then came back and re-interviewed about 90% of the same people after the Republican convention. If you look at their table, they found tremendous stability. 95% of the original Obama supporters are still for Obama. I think 92% of the original McCain supporters are still for McCain. There was a little bit of movement toward McCain among the previously undecided, but that was a relatively small group of only about 10%. So, you know, tremendous stability there, not a whole lot of change.
Joining us now is Nate Silver, political analyst who blogs at 538.com, and he's a contributor to The New Republic. Thanks for joining us, Nate Silver.
Thank you.
To continue our audience's tutorial on the complexities of polling, which I think is useful at this time since the major newspapers will continue to be coming out with new polls all the time, and I have noticed what I consider a really significant overreaction in newspaper readers of these polls. I'd like to discuss some of the weaknesses within current polling methodology. And since those weaknesses are well known by campaign professionals, it's one of the reasons why they invest less emotionally in the results of polls than the average newspaper reader. For example, I think one that's been discussed widely recently is the difficulty of reaching a good cross-section of voters through telephone contact now that there are so many barriers to telephone solicitation at home that are set up so that people don't answer those calls. And then also the cell phone population, cell phone-only population, which has become a growing population and is essentially unreachable by polling, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, this is kind of the dirty little secret of polling. Only about 20% of people nowadays will take your phone calls, and the number drops every year. And it's not evenly distributed throughout the population. Like you mentioned, about half the population age 30 and under relies on cell phones exclusively or primarily. And most pollsters will not call cell phones. There are a couple of exceptions now. Gallup is doing a cell phone supplemental sample. But for the most part, you're missing all these voters. You can try and kind of work your way around it by saying, well, since we miss half the 20-year-olds, we'll kind of weight the ones we do have twice over. But that introduces a lot more margin for error, a lot more uncertainty. There have been a couple studies done saying this might be shortchanging Obama's number by a couple of points. But it's not easy when kind of 80% of people you want to reach, either you can't reach because they have a cell phone or they won't kind of take your phone call in the first place.
Well, you use the word weight in there, that pollsters, when they get their results at a certain point in the process, almost always have to weight those results. What does that mean?
Well, it means, for example, they try and make sure that their demographics are sensible as far as Census Bureau data and whatever else. If you have a poll in Kenya, you probably want about 20% of your sample to be African-American. if it's 30%, you've probably done something wrong. If it's done something wrong, let's try and compensate for that by weighting different data more heavily or less heavily. But that's one reason why, you know, anytime you do that, you're kind of having some parts of the sample speak louder than it really kind of should statistically. And so, you know, that's why the true margin of error in polls are a lot higher than the ones that are kind of reported. That's one of a number of reasons why.
Well, to put it most crudely, what weighting seems to involve is taking some of the responses to the poll and simply throwing them out, and then, in effect, adding responses to the poll that didn't occur.
In a way, yeah, where you might say, you know, I have a sample of 900 people, but some people you might have kind of too many, you know, older voters, for instance, tend to answer the phone more often. So you might be kind of throwing out some old votes and saying, well, you know, we can't get any of these kind of young Hispanic voters in our sample, so we're going to kind of weight those triple. So that really kind of reduces the truly active sample size versus kind of what the one that's reported.
And that presumably is where the science of polling starts to become much more the art of polling.
Right. It's not easy, especially in an election like this one where, you know, graphics are different, where you might, I think, have turnout approaching 65 or 70% of registered voters. On the one hand, you probably can't just take anyone who says, yeah, I'm registered and treat them equally. On the other hand, to assume that the turnout patterns are the same as 2004, when in the Democratic primaries you had youth participation up by 50%, Latino participation up by that amount as well. You know, so there are a lot of differences of opinion about, you know, how to account for that, about whether to adjust for party ID, which has shifted a lot toward the Democrats, but maybe now it's wearing off a bit as kind of Bush fatigue, I think, lessens. So there, you know, these are unresolved questions, and they're all being kind of experimented on in real time. We won't really know who's right until, you know, until last election day.
Mark Ambender, why do the campaigns frequently say they pay no attention to the national polls that are published by the major newspapers?
Well, a few reasons. I think some of it is because they have their own polls with their own turnout assumptions built into them, so they're more likely to trust the polls that, and as humans are in general, trust the polls that reconfirm what their own preconceptions of the race are. And I think it's also sort of a rhetorical point to comfort reporters. You notice that campaigns tend not to trust the polls that show them behind, and they're eager to tout the polls that show them ahead. So I think you're dealing with, at least on some level, again, just a way to try and present, oh, everything is fine, nothing to panic, nothing to worry about. And look, the Obama campaign, I think, in general, I mean, there are some strategists on the periphery of the campaign who are worried. But I spoke yesterday with David Plouffe, the campaign manager, and some other Obama strategists. I get the sense that they are concerned in the sense that campaigns, you know, David Plouffe is paid to be concerned with 2 months left to go, but they're confident in their strategy, not terribly worried, a little bit flexible in their tactics. And, you know, what they're looking at, what the Obama campaign is looking at, are polling in the 18 targeted states that they have. And there really hasn't been much, if any, change in those numbers for a while. I mean, those states seem to be, and we'll know, and usually state, if there's a trend in a national poll, and Nate, whose blog I really enjoy and whose writing I think is very smart, can correct me on this, but usually there's a little bit of a lag between when something moves nationally and then when something moves in the state. So I think the Obama campaign is going to be waiting to see whether they start to lose some ground in battleground states over the next couple of weeks. But as of now, they're not, and they're pretty confident.
We'll continue this conversation after a brief break. On Reporter's Notebook later on, the sidelining of New England's Superman, Patriots quarterback Tom Brady. Back in a minute with To the Point from PRI.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
I'm Lawrence O'Donnell, sitting in for Warren Olney today on To the Point. We're talking about what the latest polls tell us about the presidential race. Joining us is Alan Abramowitz, a Berkeley professor of political science at Emory University. Professor Abramowitz, do the national polls that are, in effect, commissioned by newspapers for the most part, that then drive news stories for the press, which the press then relies on in a certain way to then question candidates? For example, Barack Obama was questioned this morning 3 times about polls.
Mm-hmm.
Is there some kind of manipulation of the news cycle that is intentionally or not being managed here by the news media itself?
Well, I think that there's an excessive preoccupation with the horse race question. And I think that the American public would probably be better served if there was less coverage of the horse race and more coverage of the candidates' records and their positions on the issues. I mean, this is an old story. This has been the case for many, many years. We see that the media tend to focus very, very heavily on the horse race to the detriment of other, you know, kinds of stories other than, you know, perhaps stories about candidates' personalities and families and things like that. So, you know, we don't get a whole lot of coverage of what one might call the substance of the race. And but, yeah, I think there's definitely a problem here with this excessive focus on and attempt to overinterpret the results of these polls.
Going back to Nate Silver, political analyst who blogs at 538.com and contributed to the New Republic. Nate Silver, there is another layer of polling going on that a voter would have to dig a little deeper to find, and that is the plotting of the Electoral College map, which you will hear done, I think, very well by Chuck Todd on MSNBC, John King on CNN. They were both doing it last night, and they were both slightly different. I think the margin, both of them favored Obama. The path to the Electoral College victory favored Obama. He was ahead in both of their accountings, but by significantly different amounts. Is that the way to follow the what we know about the polling results from this point forward?
I think so. I mean, that's how our president is determined, is I think people in 2000. At the same time, it shouldn't be too overstated. I mean, the Electoral College, if the election's within about 3 points or so in the popular vote, mathematically it becomes fairly impossible for candidate to lose the popular vote by more than about 3 points and win the Electoral College. But with this election being so close, you know, it could be in that range where it matters. Our methodology says that Obama probably has some built-in edge in the Electoral College. He's more likely to lose the popular vote and win the Electoral College than the other way around. And part of it is he's still playing offense in more states. At least in the kind of pre-convention universe, he was kind of defending Michigan and New Hampshire, but was playing offense in Virginia, Colorado, New Mexico, Florida, all these different kind of fairly large states. You know, so what the McCain folks are hoping for, I think, right now is that a state that looked like it was off the board, like Pennsylvania or Wisconsin, comes back into play. If all they're doing is playing defense and plug all these different holes, then, you know, Obama just kind of needs one kind of lucky lottery to win on election day. Even if he loses the popular vote by a point or two, you know, but if they can put Wisconsin into play because Sarah Palin helps there, then it's kind of more, you know, there might not be a systematic for Obama in the Electoral College anymore.
Joining us now is Stephen Koff, Washington Bureau Chief for the Cleveland Plain Dealer. Thanks for joining us, Mr. Koff.
Hi, Lawrence. Thank you.
Ohio, your newspaper's state, is once again being looked at as possibly the decider of the presidential race. I was there for the weekend between the Democrat and Republican conventions, and in studying the Obama ground game there, as they call it, the get-out-the-vote operation, I was told by both sides, actually, including the Republican side, that the Democratic get-out-the-vote operation in Ohio looks better this time than 4 years around 4 years ago, when the Bush operation was the best anyone had ever seen. Is that the kind of thing that, in fact, made the difference 4 years ago in Ohio and could make the difference again this time in Ohio?
It made a significant difference. I don't know if I'd say it was the difference, but it was a significant difference. And part of the reason why the Bush campaign had a superior operation was because it was neighbor to neighbor. It was church member to church member. It was individuals who knew one another and could call their friends and could call their friends' friends and knock on doors and knew one another from the community, whereas the Democratic operation at the time was largely what I'd call almost outsourced. You had very well-meaning, idealistic people coming in from across the country and knocking on the doors of strangers. Sometimes they talk with a strange accent. Sometimes they didn't look like, or they looked like they were from somewhere else. This time around, the Democrats seem to have gotten smart about that. So when they're working, for instance, in Lima, Ohio, in Allen County, they've got folks who are from the community who are knocking on these doors, and people can say, "Hey, Jim, yeah, I kind of recognize you. I remember you from the PTA." And so, you know, will that make a difference? Perhaps, because you get a little bit more, I suppose, of buy-in in the community.
I saw exactly that in Lima, Ohio, when I was there. It was a small basketball tournament set up for the afternoon, and people from the neighborhood arriving, and the Obama campaign was all over that event with local people working it very hard, as well as, by the way, trying to bring the cell phone into this operation of Get Out the Vote. They are trying to create a texting network of cell phone numbers where they will be able to, on election day, be texting everyone who expressed interest in their campaign to try to get them there. This I don't believe, is technology we saw used last time around.
No, it's fascinating. I mean, it's a whole new universe, and in almost every way we look at the campaigns, it's new. So much of it's new, even to those of us who cover campaigns.
Moving to another battleground state, the state of Florida, we're joined now by Damian Cave, Miami Bureau Chief for the New York Times. Thanks for joining us, Mr. Cave.
Sure, my pleasure.
Hillary Clinton came to Florida yesterday. She gave a few speeches. The reviews seem to indicate she could have been somehow more enthusiastic for the Obama-Biden ticket. Was that your reading of those events?
Well, what's interesting is the event yesterday, I think, actually answered a call for her to be here more often and working harder on behalf of Obama that I heard at a rally a few weeks ago. At that earlier rally, there was definitely a sense that Hillary Clinton needed to get out more, needed to build the case and sort of heal the rift between the camps. But this latest event, I think, is in some ways a response to that. A lot of the people that I had talked to who had been Clinton supporters but moved over to Obama really desperately kind of want that rift to be healed, particularly in Florida, which is a difficult state for Obama, in part for generational reasons.
And what are Florida polls showing at this point?
At this point, the polls are pretty even. The latest polls that I've seen basically make it a dead heat, with the caveat that it does appear to lean, if any, in any direction, towards McCain, again, because this is a state full of retirees over 40, McCain has a pretty strong edge over Obama. So, and that's the case in Florida, too. So in some ways, it will come down to those folks and whether or not some of them can have their minds changed.
Now, will McCain use the internals of his polling and Obama use the internals of his polling to target different demographic groups in Florida, or will they both be fighting over possibly the same demographic group in order to get the win?
Well, I mean, one thing the Obama camp is doing a lot of is going to things like naturalization ceremonies, you know, for new immigrants who are newly becoming citizens and voters. They're doing a lot of efforts to get new voters involved in certain communities. So, and that's one thing that they're definitely doing, and their organization has really sort of ramped up in that area. But then there is also a large group of middle-aged and older voters in various different groups who I think that they'll both be fighting over. I mean, if there is a swing vote, you know, perhaps it's, you know, the old retirees somewhere in Boca Raton. That seems to be where there's a lot of attention from both camps.
Joining us from another swing state, a state that can go either way in these kinds of elections, the state of Iowa, is David Yepsen, political columnist at the Des Moines Register in Iowa. Thanks for joining us, Mr. Yepsen.
Good to be with you.
How does Iowa look this year?
It's a very close state. I suppose right now it leads towards Obama by a few points. Iowa is a little different than other states in that Obama still has an infrastructure here that he built during the caucus campaign, and I think that's far superior to anything that John McCain put together. John McCain really did not compete here that heavily in the caucuses. And so that on the margins, that is helping Barack Obama here. You know, one wild card in all of these polling, and all this polling, and I think it's true here, is how much we discount Obama on the race question. We do know from past elections that oftentimes black candidates will underperform what their polls say because there are people who just simply go into a voting booth and do not vote for a black person.
After to some extent, some of them having responded in a poll that they would.
Yes, that's correct. Mm-hmm. And another wild card in this is the growing use of cell phones by particularly a lot of younger voters. I know it vexes pollsters to have to try to find these people. They take steps to do that. But I think those two factors really make me kind of suspicious of some of this polling right now. I mean, I think it's a close election in this state, and I think that Obama has a slight lead. But this is a state that in 2000 voted for Al Gore by less than a percentage of the vote, and in 2004 it voted for President Bush by a percent, so who knows?
Now, some would argue that McCain was not competitive in Iowa because he was on the wrong side of the ethanol issue there. Do you expect that to be a significant factor in November?
No, I don't. Too much of that is of that ethanol question is too much of that is made of that issue as an explanation for what the Iowa electorate will do. I think there are other issues that drive this election. People here are concerned about the economy and health care and questions of experience. And so I think that it's much more the character of the candidates and the condition of the economy and the war in Iraq that's driving this election here.
And which one of do both campaigns have a strong presence in television advertising now in
Yes.
Iowa?
Yes, they do. Both are up, and really pounding the airwaves hard.
Now, there are some electoral maps that I've seen where some of the people calculating these things have already colored Iowa blue. Is that, that sounds premature to you, doesn't it?
It does, only because I say it. I think it leans Obama, and at least prior to the convention, you saw him with a few point lead, but that lead had dropped here as it had elsewhere. So, based upon this state's performance in the past, I'm just not willing at this point to make any bet on how it will go. I think it's more of a purple color.
Going back to Nate Silver, which states do you see as the key battleground states?
Well, there are really four states we kind of put in the top tier, and those are Ohio, Michigan, Colorado, and Virginia. Ohio is kind of a state that is a must-win for McCain. It's very hard to envision him putting together a winning map without Ohio. I think Michigan, conversely, is fairly close to being a must-win for Obama. If he doesn't win Michigan, it means he'll probably also have lost Ohio. Without those Midwestern states, he really would have to, you know, win like Virginia, North Carolina, some kind of long shot parlay. Then you have Colorado and Virginia, which kind of represent the gateways to their regions. If Obama is going to win, you know, a North Carolina or a Florida, he'll probably kind of go through Virginia first, and likewise with Colorado, you know, winning other states out west that might seem, you know, more exotic like Montana or something. Kind of Colorado and New Mexico really also are kind of the keys out there.
Going back to Alan Abramowitz, Barclay Professor of Political Science at Emory University, Professor Abramowitz, there are some surprises when I look at these electoral college maps, not so much in terms of which states are solidly blue or solidly red, but states that previously have been solidly red, like Georgia, are not solidly red right now. They are simply listed on most of these maps as leaning toward McCain, that McCain... the Republicans do not have a state like Georgia wrapped up. Is that your impression of what's going on in Georgia?
Well, I think that that reflects, you know, what the overall state of the race was, at least prior to the national conventions, that, as someone mentioned earlier, the McCain campaign was really playing defense more than it was playing offense. It was having to defend states that had previously voted for President Bush in 2004. And the Obama campaign was comfortably ahead in most of the states that John Kerry carried and was competing in some of the states that George Bush carried. So we'll have to see in a week or two, you know, once the post-convention bounce settles down, if it does settle down, whether that's still the case. Georgia, I still think, is probably a long shot for Obama. There are reports now that the Obama campaign may be pulling some of their people out and may stop advertising here, at least temporarily. They do have a big voter registration drive going on in the state in cooperation with some other groups. So Georgia will probably be much closer than it was 4 years ago, but it wasn't very close at all 4 years ago. George Bush carried the state by 17 points, so I'd be surprised if Georgia ends up being in play.
A state like North Dakota, for example, which virtually never votes Democratic in presidential races, is being worked pretty hard this time by the Obama campaign. Senator Byron Dorgan told me at the Democratic convention that the Obama campaign had 50 paid campaign workers in the state of North Dakota. At some point, if the campaign considers that state hopeless, they will start to pull those people out. Is there a spot on the calendar we should be watching for when they make decisions like that and possibly pull people out of Georgia or North Carolina or Montana, these states that, that look possibly competitive now, and move them toward the what will become the final battleground states? When would that? Could we anticipate that kind of move?
I don't think there's necessarily a single date when that will happen. If it does happen at all, I think it will depend on what their internal polling shows about the state of the race in those states. So, you know, if North Dakota continues to look competitive, then I think they'll stay there, even though it's only three electoral votes. But I think you'll see both campaigns shifting resources increasingly into the states that they believe are in play. That's what, you know, we see in every close presidential election, and I think we're going to see that on both sides this time.
Going back to David Yepsen in Iowa, are you reworking the electoral map in your head on a day-by-day basis? For example, places like Indiana that normally would go Republican are now only leaning Republican. Do you stare at that and see dynamics possibly that are similar to the dynamics in Iowa that might indicate which way those states would go?
I do. I think, I mean, we all look at those maps every day and the latest polls in each one to try to divine what may be happening here. And I think, though, in a funny way, the map is starting to look a little more like it's looked in the last two elections. Some of these same states are battleground states. States are, you know, like Georgia, we thought that was in play, and now that seems to be moving back. I think this starts to get clearer in another week once the campaigns have done their polling, and they do a lot more than any news organization does. Then I think you'll see a reallocation of people and money and other resources to states that truly are in play, where turnout is going to be an important part of the game.
Nate Silver, a final word to our listeners on how they should process these polls. I gather your suggestion would be when they read a newspaper poll, take a deep breath, consider all the possible faults that exists within the methodology, and wait a week for the next poll.
Yeah, I think right now in particular, I mean, you know, there typically is a you know, after the convention period, you know, sometimes it's sustained. It happened to, you know, in 1988, the Republicans got a bounce out of the convention and kind of held on to it. But, you know, that same year, you know, Michael Dukakis was ahead by 19 points after his convention and, you know, lost pretty badly. So I think, you know, wait a week, there are going to be something like, you know, 20 or so polls released every day now until November. So, you know, try not to cherry results through candidate, try to take a good kind of honest approach to things. But, yeah, it's you know, let cooler heads prevail, let the data kind of, you know, progress granularly. It's going to be a close election. I think, you know, up until at the very least the last debate, either candidate will have the, you know, a victory well within his grasp, and probably, I think, on election day, we'll still have no idea what's going to happen until late into the evening.
I'd like to thank all of our guests, Mark Ambender, Associate Editor at The Atlantic, Alan Abramowitz, Barclay Professor of Political Science at Emory University, Nate Silver, political analyst who blogs at 538.com and contributor to The New Republic, Stephen Koff, Washington Bureau Chief for the Cleveland Plain Dealer, Damian Cave, Miami Bureau Chief for The New York Times, and David Yepsen, political columnist at the Des Moines Register in Iowa. Quarterback Tom Brady led the New England Patriots to near perfection last season, winning every game except the Super Bowl. This season, Brady suffered an injury in the opening minutes of the first game and will be unable to play for the rest of the year. In a moment, we'll hear how New England is coping with the grief on To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/to the point.
I'm Lawrence O'Donnell, sitting in for Warren Olney, back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. New England's Superman, Patriots quarterback Tom Brady, was injured in the first quarter of the season opener and will not be able to play again until next season. Dreams of another undefeated season and a return to the Super Bowl died a sudden death in New England this week. Joining us now to describe how New England is coping with the grief is Dan Shaughnessy, a veteran sports writer for the Boston Globe and author of the recent book, Senior Year, A Father, A Son, and High School Baseball. Dan Shaughnessy, my condolences.
Well, thank you very much. Everybody's pretty bummed out back here.
Well, what are the hopes for the Patriots now? I mean, they did go on to win the game, with the first game without Tom Brady.
Right, and I think that New England fans are sort of going through the stages of grief at this point right now, and they've pretty much gotten to acceptance on this. And what they need to do is what you referenced there, which is there is still hope. The whole season is not lost. Expectations just have to be lowered significantly, but this does not mean that they can't still be a playoff team.
And do we have the potential for a Cinderella story of the substitute quarterback stepping in for the injured giant and somehow filling his shoes?
Well, interestingly enough, that's how Brady got his start, of course, in 2001. Drew Bledsoe, the incumbent, was knocked out of a game by the New York Jets. Tom Brady came in, and next thing you know, they're in the Super Bowl. And three Super Bowls later, he's the guy on top of the whole football world. So that's how Brady got his break, his start. But Bill Belichick was asked about that yesterday and said that's great fruits and apples. They really can't be compared. And it would be unfair to Matt Castle, who's the backup replacing Brady, to expect any kind of a similar unfolding of events that Brady went through 7 years ago.
How much mileage does Matt Castle have on him as a professional quarterback?
Well, it's an interesting question because his last time he started a game was in high school in 1999. And he went on to University of Southern California, where he played behind two Heisman Trophy winners. He never started a game. Carson Palmer and Matt Leinart were the guys. Then he comes to New England. He's fourth year back up here. He's playing behind Tom Brady. So he's never made a start in college or professional football. And it's unusual to go 9 years between starts and be starting a game of this magnitude when you haven't started since high school. But that's what they're facing this weekend.
Does he have a unique spot in NFL record books as the only quarterback who never started a game in college?
It can't have happened very often. I don't know. It's quite unusual, but it just was the way things went with the people he was aligned with at USC were pro-caliber players, Heisman Trophy winners. So I would say it's probably a safe guess that that's not happened.
Now, Boston sports fans are religious, but they don't believe in acts of God, it seems to me, when it comes to sports. Who are they blaming for this, for the Brady injury? Do they think Brady shouldn't have been out there playing, wasn't strong enough? Or I'm sure there's some blame going around in Boston.
Well, we do, a region built on politics, sports, and revenge. We are into the blame game at all times here, and that's undergoing now. I think that, the convenient thing, of course, is to blame the player who hit him, young Mr. Pollard, the strong safety of the Kansas City Chiefs. And Bill Belichick made a reference yesterday to the way Patriot players are taught to tackle. They're not instructed not to ever tackle below the knees. Pollard was cleared by the league. No wrongdoing, no penalty, no fine, no suspension. That he basically was blocked to the ground and was getting up off the ground. The whistle hadn't blown and did not do anything dirty or illegal in the eyes of the NFL. But he's the handy scapegoat. Absent that, you might go to the girlfriend, Gisele Bündchen, there and say that she's just bad luck charm.
Now, there is now a rule in the NFL, isn't there? And by the way, I have to confess, I don't really get warmed up to football until about an hour before the Super Bowl, so I don't follow it on a regular basis. But isn't there a rule now about how you can and cannot hit quarterbacks?
They are much more protected now. The league wants to avoid these kind of things where they, marquee players, are taken out of the mix so early in the season. And Tom Brady is the most important player in the NFL. He's the best player in the NFL. And now they're going to go 15 weeks and the playoffs without him being part of their product. So it's not a good thing for the league. And to that end, yes, they have rules where if he's running with the ball and goes into a slide, you can't touch him, can't be hit around the head, obviously below the knees, these kinds of things. And, yeah, there's been an effort to make sure they're very vulnerable because they're in a very vulnerable positions when the pass protection breaks down and the league wants to make sure and has legislated to keep these guys on the field.
And it's just bad for business to lose people like Tom Brady in the NFL, isn't it?
No question about it. It's not only bad for New England Patriots fans. This is bad for the entire NFL and the networks. You better believe it.
Because he would attract television viewers and increase the ratings and presumably affect ticket sales when he visits other cities around the season.
This is a guy, he's on the cover of GQ. He has papal visits. He's at the State of the Union address. He's a major motion pictures. He's everywhere. I mean, he's the all-time metrosexual, it's like, girls want him and guys want to be like him, and that's the quarterback of the Patriots, and now he's no longer in the mix, and the league is poorer for it.
And what's your best prediction for the Patriots season this year without him?
Well, the schedule's pretty soft. They have a lot of great players. They have a great coach. I'm saying they're going to win 9 or 10 games and still be on top of their division. Some would say that might be a stretch. One player, it's hard to imagine one player can make that much difference, but expectations have been significantly lowered from Super Bowl bound to, they hope they can make the playoffs.
Dan Shaughnessy, thank you very much for joining us, and my condolences to everyone you'll speak to today.
I'll pass those along.
Okay, thank you. Today's program was produced by Gary Scott with Katie Cooper and Andrea Brody. The technical director is Mike Newport. For more information about To The Point, visit us at kcrw.com/To The Point. I'm Lawrence O'Donnell, sitting in for Warren Olney. Join us again for To The Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.